German Panzer Corps reminded its troops that French private property was guaranteed by the terms of the 1940 armistice, and that here in the West the German Wehrmacht is at war with the Anglo-Americans, not with France. If these rules were not always observed, that was often down to the pressure of the fighting, and any balance sheet of the campaign's effect on civilians must acknowledge that Allied bombing, however militarily necessary it may have been, and conducted in the cause of liberation, though it certainly was, may have taken as many as 19,000 civilian lives during the Normandy campaign. During July, numbers swung firmly against the Germans, and their commanders knew it. At the beginning of the month, the Allies already had nearly 3,800 tanks in Normandy, against the Germans 1,200 to 1,300. Rundstedt, increasingly despondent and feeling his health could no longer take the strain, even though Rommel was doing most of the operational toiling, was replaced as Commander-in-Chief West following a particularly tetchy telephone exchange between Rundstedt himself and Field Marshal Keitel. Rundstedt's replacement was Field Marshal von Kluger, but Kluger's own optimism evaporated as soon as he saw conditions at the front. Rommel, meanwhile, was exhausted, his lack of a strategic reserve now compelling him to abandon defense in depth and instead try to plug gaps in the line by cannibalizing his mechanized units elsewhere along the front. No longer could these units be used for concentrated counterattack. Instead, Rommel had to use them as an on-call fire brigade wherever they were needed. On 15 July, Rommel wrote, "The troops have fought heroically everywhere, but the unequal battle is nearing its end." By 23 July, the 400,000 German troops in Normandy faced 1.5 million Allied troops. When Rommel was badly wounded in a Spitfire attack on his staff car, Kluger had to replace him temporarily as commander of Army Group B, in addition to continuing to occupy his own position as Commander-in-Chief West. In the aftermath of Goodwood, and as a measure of how badly the Germans' successful defense against it had ravaged their own strength, Kluger told Hitler that the Germans could not hold out in Normandy for much longer. Hitler's refusal to listen was partly due to what could be mildly termed competing pressures. One was the colossal offensive the Red Army launched in Belarus on 22 June, codenamed Operation Bagration. By June 1944, German-occupied Belarus jutted out into Soviet territory. It included the land bridge between the River Dvina in the north and the River Dnieper in the south, with the Pripyat marshes protecting its southern flank. The Ostheer still had 165 divisions in June 1944, compared with the Westheer's 65. However, considering the size of its front, the Westheer was proportionately stronger. Moreover, the great majority of panzer divisions were in the west. Hitler was set on holding on to the Belarusian balcony, not only because he believed in rigid defense, but also because he saw Belarus as a springboard for a future German counteroffensive. He placed faith in the string of fortified places Army Group Center had established during the 9 months in which it had reconstituted its front line, including Vitebsk, Orsha, Mogilev, and Bobruisk. Multiple rings of strong points, anti-tank ditches and mines defended them. On 8 March 1944, Hitler decreed that any commander of a fortified place seeking to abandon his position must first obtain permission from his army group commander. The Führer, under ever more pressure from both the situation and his own deteriorating health, now entirely ignored any viewpoint different from his. Army Group Center's operations section warned there were too many fortified places, and that the men, ammunition, and materials needed to hold them would deprive both the rest of the front and the anti-partisan campaign. General Jodl favored withdrawing to the shortest defensible line between the Baltic and the Black Sea, freeing up 20 divisions that could then be redeployed. His proposal would at best have delayed the inevitable. In any case, Hitler rejected it. It was partly a measure of the tenacity of the Ostheer's defense of 1943 that the Red Army's own manpower situation was a serious worry to it by 1944. General Balck noticed the effects at the front. "We had become completely convinced that the Russians were scraping the bottom of the barrel," he later recalled. However, the Red Army compensated by recruiting women to various combat and other roles, and more generally by continuing to reform its units along combined arms lines and refine its practice of deep battle. Among other things, the Red Army changed its artillery tactics to make deep battle less predictable. The Germans often stayed in cavernous bunkers before running outside to take up position when Soviet fire tailed off. Soviet guns thus began to disorientate the Germans by shelling them intensively, then letting up for a few minutes, drawing the Germans outside, and shelling them again in the open. Soviet tank crews benefited from improved training in one of the 50 tank training schools that had been established by 1943. The Tiger and Panther could outfight the T-34 1-1, but the T-34-85 had narrowed the gap. If German defences proved too strong at one point, the Soviets would switch their attack to another. Despite their manpower worries, the Soviets' improved tactics and material resources still enabled them to attack several points at once while keeping significant forces in reserve. This kept the Germans permanently guessing as to when and where the Soviets would attack next. Hitler's refusal to allow German forces to withdraw undoubtedly made the Soviets' task easier by surrendering the initiative to them even more completely. For the summer of 1944, Red Army planners decided to concentrate their main effort on Army Group Center, now commanded by Field Marshal Ernst Busch. This would sever Army Group Center's link with Army Group North, drive the Ostheer out of virtually all that remained of German-held Soviet territory, and get the Red Army into Poland along the most direct route to Berlin. The Red Army aimed to encircle and destroy much of Army Group Center in a huge pocket east of Minsk. The first phase of the operation involved eliminating the German anchor positions in the northern and southern flanks of the Belarusian Balkany, with the Soviets eventually reaching a line west of Minsk, 150 kilometers, 94 miles from their jumping-off points. Marshal Konev's first Ukrainian front was also to play a key role, thrusting up from the south, destroying German forces east of Lvov, and attacking northwest towards the Vistula. The Soviets implemented an elaborate deception plan to convince the Germans that Konev's attack would come from the Stanislav sector north of the Carpathian foothills. Indeed, the Soviets had grown more adept at deception and secrecy in general. Among other things, their ability to attack anywhere along the line meant the Germans had to reckon with the possibility of attack any time and anywhere. All this was happening as the Germans' intelligence effort, despite the ongoing efforts of the FHO and FLO to improve their operation, continued to dry up. The demands of the Luftwaffe elsewhere deprived it of reconnaissance aircraft in the east. And as the Ostheer's losses and the Reich's economic needs grew more severe, the German army gutted its own intelligence personnel for other, supposedly more pressing, duties. In June 1943, for instance, one of the OKH's seven top cryptanalysts was transferred to the infantry, and intelligence officers working in the Reich often had to down tools to help with the potato harvest. A vicious circle was established. As the quality of intelligence deteriorated, so did the Germans' position at the front, and German military chiefs became too preoccupied by the position at the front to worry about intelligence. The Soviets pressed home their advantage during the weeks and days before the offensive by maintaining complete radio silence along much of the front. While German military intelligence knew a Soviet offensive was imminent then, it knew not when, where, or in what strength it would strike. If anything, it considered Army Group North Ukraine the likeliest target for attack, with Army Group Center facing a subsidiary offensive at most. In the words of General of Artillery Robert Martinek, commander of 39 Panzer Corps, "Whom God would destroy, he first strikes blind." Yet even if the Germans had known exactly when and where the hammer would fall, their forces were too depleted to do much about it. Army Group Center's order of battle, comprising 36 frontline and 9 reserve divisions, included substandard Luftwaffe field divisions, security divisions, and Hungarian units, as well as increasingly threadbare regular army divisions. By June 1944, demands further west had stripped the Ostheer of the majority of its armor and air cover. For instance, Army Group Center had 100 single-engine fighters to protect it. 40 were in working order, and even these lacked fuel. and though Army Group Center might still command large numbers of troops, they lacked the mechanized strength for immediate counterattacks. Among other things, Bush could call on only one Panzer Division in reserve. Many of his troops were tied down in rear-area anti-partisan operations. The horse had long replaced the truck as Army Group Center's transportation mainstay. Technologically, Army Group Center, indeed the Ostheer itself, resembled the German army of the First World War, rather than the more mechanized forces of the Westheer. By 22 June 1944, the day on which the Soviets unleashed Operation Bagration on Army Group Center, the German forces in the White Russian balcony were outnumbered nearly 4-1 in men, more than 9-1 in artillery, more than 10-1 in aircraft, and, most staggeringly of all, 23-1 in tanks. One divisional commander exaggerated only slightly when he commented that no procedure has been invented which ensures a successful defense if you face the enemy in a ratio of 1-100. The timing of the launch of Operation Bagration, 3 years to the day after the opening of Operation Barbarossa, was coincidental but chilling. Soviet artillery pulverized the German forward lines, the Red Air Force dominated the skies, and partisans extensively sabotaged German transport and communications. Few German soldiers were able to write letters in these circumstances, but Unteroffizier Julfried K. of the 25th Panzer Grenadiers, now part of the 4th Army, managed to do so 2 days after the operation started. "After all our exertions, I am dead beat," he wrote. "The Russian began by bombarding us with all his strength. It lasted 3 hours. He then tried to break through with all violence. The force was unstoppable. I just ran." The Red Army's tanks penetrated deep into the German rear and reached the River Beresina. General Rokossovsky's 1st Belarusian Front used bridges and causeways to penetrate the supposedly impenetrable Pripyat Marshes, a flanking movement that took them into the Germans' rear. The Soviet Third Army broke through to the north. The two thrusts together encircled and destroyed the German Ninth Army in a pocket around Bobruisk. By early July, the Fourth Army had been encircled east of Minsk. Hitler's much-vaunted fortified places were everywhere bypassed or overrun. In every case, they were rendered irrelevant. By now, the Red Army's level of mechanization was such that the majority of its vehicles could travel across country, ignoring the road and rail junctions that the fortified places guarded. Hitler tried to coordinate the defense against Bagration as well as the battle in Normandy from his headquarters on the Obersalzburg. Zeitzler, the OKH chief of staff, wanted to detach troops from Army Group North southwards to try to cut off the Red Army's forward units. This was certainly something the Soviets feared. Even at this stage, the German army's aptitude for maneuver warfare was something they did not underestimate. This time, however, they overestimated it, for such a goal was far beyond Army Group North's means. In any case, Hitler refused to weaken Army Group North's front. Zeitzler, mentally exhausted by his now constant arguments with Hitler, signed himself off with illness at the start of July. In a parting shot, he accused Hitler of twice bludgeoning him into courses of action against his judgment, once with Stalingrad and once with the Crimea. He feared Hitler would do the same to him over Army Group North, but refused to be pressured a third time. He believed it was his duty to inform Hitler that the war was lost, and that something must be done now to end it. Zeitzler's replacement, officially on an acting basis in addition to his duties as Inspector General of Armored Troops, was General Guderian. Army Group Center's eventual losses might have been marginally less horrific, but for its commander, Field Marshal Busch had been promoted far more for his slavish loyalty than for his dubious ability. In the run-up to Bagration, he did not assert himself enough to demand armored reinforcements beyond his pathetically small Panzer reserve, and he accepted Hitler's fortified places strategy without question. On the one occasion when Busch did request a withdrawal, in May 1944, Hitler needled him for being a defeatist, knowing full well that this would sting the Field Marshal into even dumber obedience. Busch's total lack of initiative cost the Germans dear during the first week of Bagration before the situation stabilized to any extent. During this period, while Busch slavishly adhered to Hitler's Standfast order, the great majority of units that the Germans would lose in Bagration were wiped out. "What shall I do?" Busch repeatedly asked his chief of staff. At the end of June, even Hitler realized that Busch's needy subservience was no answer to the unfolding catastrophe, and replaced him with Field Marshal Model. Model was eventually able to salvage something from the catastrophe. After he took over as commander of Army Group Center, the Red Army never again achieved a major encirclement of German forces in the east. Model remained as scathing, sarcastic, and indeed threatening as ever towards subordinates who did not come up to scratch. "Thankfully, he leaves my corps alone after I had bared my teeth," wrote General Balch. "For the troops, he is unbearable." Lieutenant General Gläser von Hochstenau recounted a conversation with a colleague from the east who told him, "Model is one of the most brutal Wehrmacht generals. Only the loudmouth Ferdinand Schirner is worse." Yet Model undeniably got results, and neither was he an unquestioning acolyte. As early as the winter of 1941 to 1942, he had challenged Hitler's excessive meddling in operations in his sector, asking him, "Do you command the Ninth Army, my Führer, or do I?" By 1944, Model's reputation for salvaging dire situations had won him Hitler's confidence and enabled him to operate with a freer hand than Busch. So dire was the predicament Army Group Center's troops faced that they probably failed to appreciate any of this initially. "You have been waiting for a sign of life from me for a long time," wrote Wachtmeister Josef L. of the 129th Infantry Division on 29 July. "Today saw the end of a period in the Russian campaign that I will never forget. Not so much the fighting with the enemy as the exertions, the marching in unbearable heat through swamp and sand, left to fend for ourselves, bridges in front of us destroyed, partisans around us making our lives a misery." Hans Sauer described an apocalyptic spectacle to his fiancée as the Germans were driven westwards. "At the moment we're in Białystok. From our firing position this lovely city looks like a burning sea of houses. So far I've experienced the destruction of Slutsk, Baranovichi, Volkovisk, Sokolka, and now Białystok." When the Red Army leadership realized the extent of their success, they ordered the offensive onwards beyond its initial objectives. By early August, Model faced not only the Soviet onrush through Belarus, but also a new Red Army offensive from the south. The Soviets' blood was up, and they had abandoned their earlier caution in favor of driving up to the Baltic coast, cutting across the German rear, and encircling the remnants of Army Group Center. Model responded with daring and enterprise. He was able to marshal just 8 weakened divisions against 116 rifle divisions, 6 cavalry divisions, 19 motorized rifle brigades, and 42 tank brigades. Amazingly, he succeeded in throwing this enormous force off balance before Warsaw by attacking its spearheads in the flank. Model's counterattack unsettled the Soviets, reminded them again that maneuver warfare was still something the Germans were dangerously good at, and halted their offensive. Yet the cost to the Germans of Bagration had been phenomenal. Army Group Center had lost 30 divisions and 300,000 men. Of these, 57,000 were paraded through Moscow on 17 July like an ancient Roman triumph. When Army Group Center was virtually destroyed, it took Army Group North's southern flank with it, and Army Group North had to retreat into Courland to salvage its position. In turn, this opened the way for a Soviet offensive into the Baltic states. Because this particular offensive was subsidiary to the main one taking place in Belarus, the Germans were able to stem it with a counterattack at Riga. But Courland remained the only region of the Soviet Union the Wehrmacht still held. Elsewhere along the front, the Red Army now stood at the frontier of East Prussia, the Vistula below Warsaw, and the Hungarian border along the Carpathians. Meanwhile, on 20 July, Henning von Treskow and his fellow military conspirators had made their most daring attempt to overthrow the Nazi regime. The story has been well told elsewhere, not least in the 2008 Tom Cruise film Valkyrie. The bare bones of the background and course of that day's events are as follows. Tresco and his fellow military conspirators, after failing in earlier attempts on Hitler's life, believed the replacement army was key to overthrowing the Nazi regime. Operation Valkyrie called for replacement army units to suppress large-scale internal unrest in Germany. Suitably adapted, it could form the basis of an anti-Nazi coup. A nest of conspirators, part of a much wider resistance network, was working in the replacement army's Berlin headquarters under the nose of General Fromm. Fromm himself hedged his bets, aware of what the conspirators were doing but refusing to commit himself fully. Tresco's duties on the Eastern Front limited his direct involvement in the plotting, but when one of the replacement army conspirators, Colonel Klaus von Stauffenberg, was appointed Fromm's representative on Hitler's staff at the beginning of July, the conspirators suddenly had regular direct access to Hitler. The plan was for Stauffenberg to assassinate Hitler, for the conspirators in Berlin to present Hitler's assassination as the work of opportunistic regime elements, and for them then to activate Operation Valkyrie with the ostensible aim of restoring order. Following that, under the auspices of Valkyrie, leading coup participants would arrest SS and Gestapo leaders in Berlin, Paris, where the conspirators could count on Stulpnagel, Speidel, and other officers of the military government, and elsewhere, thus nipping in the bud any potential counter-coup. The conspirators would then install an interim government with General Beck at its head, and attempt peace negotiations with the Western Allies. It was on 20 July that Stauffenberg made his attempt on Hitler's life at the Führer's daily situation conference in his forest headquarters in Rustenburg, East Prussia. But due to bad luck and bad judgment, the plot failed. Stauffenberg was unable to prime both bombs in time, and Hitler happened to move the daily situation conference from a concrete bunker to a wooden hut. Whilst a concrete bunker would have concentrated the blast, the flimsy structure of the hut had no such effect. Hitler survived, scathed and shocked, but determined to rain down bloody vengeance upon the conspirators. The plotters also failed to sever all communication from Hitler's headquarters. This enabled the Nazi leadership to broadcast the fact of Hitler's survival, marshal SS and loyal army units, and strangle the coup at birth. In an ultimately vain effort to conceal his own murky connection with the plot, Fromm immediately had Stauffenberg and three other replacement army conspirators arrested and shot. Tresco committed suicide with a hand grenade. Although a growing number of senior German field commanders knew the war was lost and had known what the plotters were about, no senior field commander had been prepared to back them wholeheartedly. For this reason, the coup itself probably would have failed even if Stauffenberg's assassination attempt had succeeded. There is firm evidence for only one serving field marshal actively supporting the coup, namely Kluge, and even he refused to back it with practical action until he could be sure Hitler was dead. The question remains, then, of why virtually all the army's senior field commanders failed to act. Many former generals would later claim that their oath to Hitler was the main thing that had deterred them from supporting the plot actively. For men who were traditionally imbued with unquestioning loyalty to the head of state, so went the reasoning, breaking an oath was difficult if not impossible to contemplate. But for many generals, the real objections were probably more calculating. The coup really had, at best, a minute chance of fulfilling all its aims. For one thing, the Western Allies, set on securing Germany's unconditional surrender and conscious of the role the army had long played in supporting the Nazi regime, had hitherto signalled no interest in a negotiated peace with senior officers. Here it should also be remembered that, undeniable though their courage was, some of the plot's participants, such as Tresco, Stulpnagel and Speidel, were implicated in Nazi crimes themselves. In any case, the conspirators might not even have made it as far as issuing an ultimatum, for even a successful coup may well have precipitated civil war. And civil war, unless it was concluded quickly, would almost certainly have caused the battlefronts to cave in, with huge loss of life among the fighting troops. Granted, this scenario might have been preferable for Germany in the long run, for it would have shortened the war and reduced the further death toll it would go on to suffer. But this was not a scenario many generals would have willingly entertained. Officers may also have made self-interested calculations. Had civil war broken out, the smart money would have been on pro-regime forces, because the conspirators would probably have been unable to rally sufficient support across the Wehrmacht. Under those circumstances, a re-established Nazi regime, perhaps with Himmler at its head, undoubtedly would have wiped out all the coup's prominent supporters. Self-interested as these motives were, other motives were downright venal. Numerous generals were materially and financially beholden to Hitler and the Nazi regime. Throughout the war, they had enjoyed not only promotion, but also lavish rewards in land and money. Indeed, Kluger himself had been one such lucky recipient. Shabbiest of all, perhaps, was the conduct of General Guderian. In early 1944, he was awarded vast new estates in Poland and generous funds for their upkeep. Guderian had no compunction in having the estate's previous Polish owners turfed out. Their eventual fate is unknown, but they were probably handed over to the security police and SD. Generals who, at least in part, had supported the Nazi regime for such self-serving ends may well have lost their moral compass entirely, and this too made them less likely to support a coup attempt. Guderian himself seems to have properly hedged his bets on 20 July. He was already aware of the conspiracy without either committing himself to it or reporting it to Hitler. He was then conveniently out of contact for almost the whole day, as he hunted deer alone on his estate, until he returned to see what course the day's events had run. Another excuse many former generals proffered for their inertia was that the troops themselves were too indoctrinated to have tolerated a coup attempt. Leaving aside the fact that the generals themselves had been instrumental in indoctrinating the troops, many ordinary German soldiers across all fronts did react with outrage when news of the attempted coup was announced. This does not necessarily mean they retained their faith in Hitler, though it seems a great many still did. But because of the chaos a successful coup probably would have unleashed, chaos that would also have engulfed the front line, soldiers widely considered the coup attempt a betrayal of the fighting men. A number of generals seem not to have wanted to go any further. Why, wrote Lance Corporal Karl Ludwig L. of the 90th Panzer Grenadier Division in a letter of 25 July, this question keeps rolling around my head just as it must be in yours back home. It's all about holding our nerve now, damn it. Lieutenant Peter G. of the 114th Light Division, serving in Italy, recounted, when we heard in the night from the Führer's mouth that it was generals who had committed this dishonorable baseness, our colonel, in a state I'd never seen him in before, had tears in his eyes. The first lieutenant himself called for this clique of traitors to be wiped out. Unteroffizier E., serving with Orstkommandantur 2-351, excoriated the plotters in ideological terms. We know that these crooks are all Freemasons and are therefore cooperating with international Jewry, or rather, they're enthralled to it. It's a shame I couldn't be there in the action against this pack of scum. It would have been a real pleasure to have let loose against them with my machine pistol. The soldiers may also have been appalled at the plot because so thoroughly had they imbibed military values that the thought of disobeying an order, still less the thought of trying to assassinate the commander-in-chief, was inconceivable. This was certainly the view of a number of soldiers held in Western Allied captivity. Indeed, the troops' faith in Hitler resurged after 20 July, some seeing in his survival an omen that Germany would indeed prevail. Peter G. declared, "The most important thing is that nothing happens to our Führer. That is the best providence that can strengthen our faith." Despite everything, wrote Lieutenant F.B. of the 7th Panzer Division, "the one thing that keeps us believing in victory is our belief in the Führer and his words. We must hold on until our new weapons have been put in place. Therefore, despite our fears, we are not without hope. Indeed, our mood is the best." As late as November, a report by 89 Corps, which the Canadian First Army captured, described the content of the soldiers' mail that its censors had intercepted. In spite of the fact that there are now more letters showing a rather weak belief in the final victory, the whole of the mail still proves a strong confidence. They still trust the Führer as much as ever, and some even think that the destiny of the German people depends on him alone. Indeed, Western Allied surveys showed that Hitler remained popular among German POWs, his approval ratings consistently higher than 60% until a few weeks before the war ended. As the regime reasserted control, generals, many of whom had at least had some contact with the conspirators, fell over one another to protest their loyalty to the regime. From late summer onwards, the officer corps would be brutally purged and further emasculated, and the army as a whole would undergo still more intensive indoctrination as the regime sought to bind it ever more firmly to the war effort until the last possible moment. In France, as the Germans in Normandy approached crisis point, German forces in the rest of the country faced mushrooming resistance. The 157th Reserve Infantry Division, for instance, lost 650 men killed or wounded between 6 June and 15 August, a more than tenfold increase on the entire first 5 months of 1944. On 22 June, Captain Richard D., stationed in Bordeaux, wrote, "The resistance movement in France is assuming gradually more unpleasant forms. One must be prepared for a possibly major imminent blow by the franc-tireurs. They are receiving weapons from the air and have had a big influx of members since the invasion." This was a pressure cooker situation in which German units in France, as in Italy, faced irregular resistance at their rear at the same time as they faced intense fighting at their front. "Yesterday afternoon we returned from anti-partisan duty," wrote Hans S. to his fiancée on 15 June. "You won't believe how happy we are to be back here at the signals school. These 14 days were awful. The infantryman in his foxhole has it much better. I don't want to say any more. A young lass won't want to know what we experienced in these 14 days, and I don't want to remind myself either." That said, army units in France did not bloody their hands as much as some of their army comrades in Italy. This may have been partly because they did not hold the French population in the same contempt as the Italian. The worst atrocity any German unit committed in France, at this or any other time between 1940 and 1944, was the work of a company of the 2nd SS Panzer Division, Das Reich, when it murdered 642 men, women and children in the village of Oradour-sur-Glane, northwest of Limoges, on 10 June. These troops ticked every box for extreme brutality. As part of one of the original Waffen-SS divisions, they were both highly fanaticized and consciously elite in their self-image. They had also seen extensive action in the East. Most of the violence the army meted out towards French civilians during the summer of 1944 took place in the battle against the Maquis. Back in Poland in 1939 and 1940, General Johannes Blaskowitz had voiced courageous moral objections to the depredations of the SS. Now, as commander of Army Group G in southern France, he sought to ensure that his own troops did not kill civilians indiscriminately in their struggle against the Maquis. "We have to be sure to be guided by the thought that we are fighting the terrorist, not the innocent civilian, who is frequently himself suffering from the terrorist." Perhaps ambiguously, however, he expected them to comport themselves severely against anyone who did not actively assist in the anti-partisan campaign. "The French civilian who is not a terrorist and not involved in terrorism has to make sure he takes an active stand against it." This made the troops more likely to visit death upon civilians who were caught in the middle and simply trying to keep their heads down. Blaskowitz did request permission from OB West to assure resistance members that they would not be punished if they surrendered voluntarily, but OB West refused. And on 1 August, the OKW ordered that all able-bodied males, even suspected of supporting the Maquis, be transported from contaminated areas to the Reich for forced labor. The corpus of directives that governed army formations fighting the Maquis did not license unbridled barbarism then, but they did license ruthless severity. One unit that exercised such severity was Kampfgruppe Wilde of the 11th Panzer Division. Unlike the majority of the 11th, this battle group's men came primarily from two replacement battalions of the 273rd Reserve Panzer Division. Its commander, Lieutenant Colonel Wilde, had had little frontline experience. Its young soldiers, however, had undergone extensive indoctrination from school and the Hitler Youth upwards. During June 1944, the battle group carried out anti-partisan operations in the Dordogne, in which it shot most of its partisan prisoners on the spot, shot civilians in reprisals, and on one occasion burned down a village to the last house. Kampfgruppe Wilde accused the local military administration of weakness in anti-partisan warfare, and of applying standards that may have been right and good for the police president of Potsdam in 1910. It also claimed to have killed more than 300 partisans at Moulevier on 21 and 22 June. However, compared with the men of the Das Reich Division who committed the Oradour massacre, a singularly low point of comparison, admittedly, Kampfgruppe Wilde's actions were actually measured. A more reliable post-war French account of the Moulevier killings show that the battle group accounted for only 75 partisans, not 300. It seems it had talked up its success for the record. The battle group killed adult males in reprisals, while the SS men at Oradour took no account of age or gender. And the division to which Kampfgruppe Wilde belonged also put several of its soldiers on trial for plundering and raping civilians. Kampfgruppe Wilde then acted with ruthless severity, but not with barbaric savagery. The 189th Reserve Division, which fought in the French Alps, behaved similarly. On 8 July, one of its regiments shot 76 partisan prisoners. Like Kampfgruppe Wilde, the 189th was not an elite unit, even though Kampfgruppe Wilde's superior formation, the 11th Panzer Division, was indeed such a unit. Unlike Kampfgruppe Wilde, however, the 189th possessed few indoctrinated young recruits. The fact that both units comported themselves harshly, despite the difference in their personnel, suggests they acted as they did mainly because they were in full accord with the ruthless directives they had received. They almost certainly shared the army's hatred of irregular warfare and a bitter frustration that they were having to expend time and energy against a partisan opponent when the battlefront further north was under such pressure. During late July and August, the Luftwaffe's General Heinrich Niehoff, commander of the Army Area Southern France, launched Operation Vercours southwest of Grenoble. Against 4,000 Maquis on the Vercours plateau, the Germans committed the bulk of the 157th Reserve Division, together with troops from the 9th Panzer Division, artillery, mountain troops, paratroopers, eastern auxiliaries, and units of the security police. Operation Vercours was at best a very partial success. Around 640 Maquis died on the plateau, but the great majority escaped. The terrain on the plateau did much to hold up the Germans. The unit diarist for a mountain troop company, for instance, recorded the problems the troops encountered in trying to winkle out the defenders of a cave on 23rd July. Marksmen were used, however, the success was limited as they could not make a frontal approach to the cave. A demolition charge was also attempted, but due to the terrain, these were very difficult to attach. We had no success. The operation did, however, bring Eastern methods to France more emphatically than any other German anti-partisan operation. On 25 July, for instance, the 8th Company of Reserve Mountain Battalion 298 shot 28 partisans, including male doctors, and sent 7 nurses to a concentration camp. But the most savage acts of all were the work of units that were not of the German army, paratroops, eastern troops, and above all the security police. While General Niehoff must shoulder responsibility for the depravities committed on the plateau, then, here too there were limits to the brutality of the army's units on the ground. It would be unseemly, if not grotesque, to argue that shooting large numbers of male civilians as reprisal victims was measured conduct in any normal sense, especially as the men who did the shooting belonged to an oppressive foreign occupation force. Nevertheless, the German army's anti-partisan campaign displayed different gradations of savagery in different parts of occupied Europe. Seen in this context, the worst actions of the army units that participated in the final bout of anti-partisan warfare in occupied France certainly did not belong among the most measured examples of German conduct, but nor did they belong among the worst. In all likelihood, the unit's contempt for irregular warfare and for the civilian populations who may have been supporting it was considerable. But it would have been greater still, and the troops' capacity for cruelty with it, Had these units borne more of the hallmarks that characterized the Army's worst perpetrators? Their superiors' expectations were less severe, and the direct conditions they faced less desperate than was so often the case in Eastern and Southern Europe. They harbored no elite pretensions or, perhaps most crucially, singular degrees of fanaticism. Across Europe as a whole, then, the German army did not uniformly imbibe the full barbaric rigor of the anti-bandit warfare so beloved at the SS and the more brutal units of the army itself. None of this would have been any consolation to the French civilians whom these units killed or bereaved. Around 20,000 French citizens, including resistors, hostages, and the condemned, perished in German operations against the French resistance. Of the 61,000 who were deported to concentration camps in Germany for resistance activities, around 40% did not return. Morally and politically, the resistance helped keep the spirit of freedom alive and offered the hope that French people could determine their future rather than wait passively for liberation. Militarily, its impact paled next to those of the Soviet and Yugoslav partisan movements. The resistance was, however, a palpable and sometimes deadly irritant to the German forces, particularly during that final summer of occupation. A new phase of the Normandy fighting was ushered in on 25 July. By now, 180 German armored fighting vehicles faced the Americans against 600 facing the British and Canadians. That day, U.S. forces unleashed Operation Cobra against the thinned German line in the Saint-Lô sector. Over the course of the previous weeks, the performance of U.S. forces had continued to improve. Among their latest innovations were new specialist rhinoceros armored fighting vehicles, which, together with bulldozers and engineer battalions, were able to clear a way through the hedgerows of the Bocage. At the command level, General Omar Bradley, commander of the U.S. First Army, had weeded out several officers whom he did not consider up to the job. Cobra itself was heralded by a colossal preliminary bombardment, including a well-coordinated carpet bombing that dropped 5,000 tons of bombs, napalm, and white phosphorus artillery round on the Germans within an area of 15 square kilometers, 6 square miles. "After an hour, I had no communication with anybody, even by radio," recalled Fritz Bayerlein, commander of the Panzerlehr Division. "By noon, nothing was visible but dust and smoke. My front lines looked like the face of the moon, and at least 70% of my troops were knocked out, dead, wounded, crazed, or numbed." Nevertheless, the cratering caused by the carpet bombing slowed the American advance. The Germans might yet have held on longer in the Saint-Lô sector, but for the ruinous impact Allied air power was now having upon their ability to move troops and supplies. On the eastern flank of the Normandy front, the Germans were able to keep ferrying reinforcements via the River Seine and a still viable railway network. But neither means could supply their western flank. The Allies also bombed German troops trying to get from railheads and loading docks to the front. An intelligence report for the Canadian First Army showed that the supply not only of fuel, vehicles, and equipment, but also of rations, was increasingly being crippled, with all the effects on morale this was likely to have. The 7th Army suffered a fatal blow to its supply when, on 15 July, Allied bombers destroyed the railway bridge and marshalling yards at Tours. This was a loss for which road deliveries could not compensate, and it happened just 10 days before Cobra commenced. In their desperate and ultimately vain efforts to contain the American breakout, German troops found themselves under increasingly intolerable pressure. Although relatively safe when entrenched, they could not assemble, maneuver, or counterattack without the risk of obliterating Allied firepower. The 2nd Panzer Division described the troops' ordeal. "The incredibly heavy artillery and mortar fire of the enemy is something new for seasoned veterans as much as for the new arrivals. The assembly of troops is spotted immediately by the enemy reconnaissance aircraft and smashed by bombs and artillery directive from the air. And if, nevertheless, attacking troops go forward, they become involved in such dense artillery and mortar fire that heavy casualties ensue, and the attack peters out within the first few hundred meters. The feeling of helplessness against enemy aircraft operating without hindrance has a paralyzing effect, and during the barrage the effect on the inexperienced men is literally soul-shattering." When a unit lost a large number of officers and NCOs, its all-important primary groups began to come apart. Panzer divisions had younger, better quality personnel, and at least some protection from Allied firepower, but some infantry units disintegrated. The first major collapse in morale came at Cherbourg, where men of the 719th Infantry Division almost mutinied. But by August, discipline in some other infantry units was also beginning to dissolve. In a post-war interview by the Americans, General Heinrich Eberbach, who took over Panzer Group West after Geyer von Schweppenburg was wounded, described the state of his troops by that stage of the campaign. The fighting morale of the German troops had cracked. They were not just exhausted and weak from hunger. The propaganda promises had all proved false. The invincibility of the Atlantic Wall, the V-weapons which would bring Britain to its knees, and the talk of newer aircraft and submarines which assured final victory. Stragglers without arms were numerous. Catch lines to the rear of the front had to be inaugurated. Even the SS was no exception to this rule. And if an intelligence report for the British Second Army is any guide, acute tensions were now emerging between Army and SS units. As supply to the front collapsed, Army soldiers increasingly complained about the superior equipment and preferential treatment many SS units enjoyed. Indeed, the cocksure youngsters of the 12th SS Panzer Division Hitlerjugend seemed to delight in rubbing their Wehrmacht comrades' noses in it. "Are you going to market?" the Hitler youth boys had mockingly inquired when soldiers of the 271st Infantry Division arrived at the front on bicycles and horse-drawn wagons. There was also at least one case of SS troops driving Wehrmacht troops into battle at gunpoint, yelling, "Push on, you dogs," as they did so. Hitler now placed immense pressure on Field Marshal von Kluger to launch an armoured counterattack, including 5 panzer divisions, against the Americans at Morta. Kluger knew any such attack would be insane, not least because it would have no air cover. Following the failure of the bomb plot, however, the Field Marshal was under intense scrutiny, so he felt he had no choice but to comply. The Mortain counterattack began on the night of 6-7 August. Though the Germans had a 2-1 numerical advantage in that sector, much of it was cancelled out by the magnitude of the U.S. artillery massed against them. For, thanks to Ultra, the Allies knew that a German counterattack there was imminent. "I am clear that the failure of this attack will lead to the collapse of the entire Normandy front," Kluger wrote on 7 August, "but the order is so unambiguous that it must be carried out unconditionally." The Mortain attack made some initial progress, but German troops spent much of it diving for cover from Allied air bombardment. The attack soon faltered and failed, and now the German forces that had been committed to it were perilously exposed. As the Americans launched their own concentrated, mechanized counterattack, and the British and Canadians advanced down from the Caen sector, the Germans were in immediate danger of being encircled around Falaise. On 10 August, after Hitler ordered him to renew the offensive, Kluger commented on the incredibility of a large military force of 20 divisions blissfully planning an attack, while far behind it an enemy is busily forming a noose with which to strangle it. Kluger's already brittle mental state shattered entirely when he learned that Field Marshal Model, now a veritable one-man fire brigade, would be replacing him as Commander-in-Chief of Army Group B. Convinced, and with good reason, that he was about to be arrested for consorting with the anti-Hitler conspirators, Kluger committed suicide with cyanide. "My Führer," his farewell note declared, "you have led a true epic struggle. History will credit you with that. Show now the greatness that is necessary to end a pointless struggle, if at all possible. I part from you, my Führer, to whom I was always more loyal than you perhaps realized, in the certainty that I did my duty to the utmost. Heil, mein Führer." Hitler may never even have read the note. Model, temporarily Commander-in-Chief West, as well as Commander of Army Group B, ordered a withdrawal. "My soldiers are burnt out," he announced on 17 August. "Allied aircraft caught the withdrawing troops in the open. Lieutenant General Heinrich Freiherr von Lüttwitz, commander of the 2nd Panzer Division, described the carnage as the Allies sought to seal and destroy the Falaise pocket. On the road, great heaps of vehicles, dead horses and dead soldiers were to be seen scattered everywhere, and the number increased from hour to hour. Enemy planes were swooping down uninterruptedly on anything that moved, recalled Hans von Luck. I could see the mushroom clouds of exploding bombs, burning vehicles and the wounded, who were picked up by retreating transports. The scenes that had to be enacted in the pocket were indescribable. Allied mistakes, however, did enable large numbers of German troops to wriggle free. The newly established Canadian First Army lacked an experienced headquarters staff and failed to coordinate properly with its air support. At various points, Allied bombers ended up hitting Canadian and Polish units by accident. German counter-bombardments disorientated the Canadians, and the Germans captured a Canadian officer with a map containing attack plans. Coordination between the Poles and Canadians was also poor, with General Simons failing to reinforce the Poles sooner because he wanted to keep his armor fresh for the advance on the Seine. Nor were the Americans blameless. Bradley, who assumed command of the U.S. 12th Army Group on 1st August, grew cautious after the Cobra breakout, partly for fear of his units outrunning their supplies. By contrast, General Patton's 3rd Army grew reckless. Thinking to catch the Germans in a double encirclement, Patton thrust too far eastwards towards the Seine, hoping in vain to achieve a double encirclement, but in the process only weakening the encirclement operation around Falaise. A corporal in the 21st Panzer Division described his crew's bid for safety. On 19 August came the order, "Every man for himself." With the 2nd Panzer IV, we set out on the way to the east. At the sight of naked, half-burned tank men, we promised ourselves that we would not let ourselves be finished off in the pocket. It was a hellish journey. In bypassing a horse-drawn column, we skidded so badly that we had to abandon our tanks. We continued on foot. During the night, we slipped past the enemy, some of whom looked at us in bewilderment. In the morning, we were through, and, for the moment, saved. But if the Germans evaded catastrophe at Falaise, they still suffered disaster. 40,000 German troops fell prisoner in the Falaise pocket, and Panzer Group West, recently renamed as a new 5th Panzer Army, lost half its men and equipment, much of it not to Allied attack, but to lack of fuel. This was the Normandy campaign's final act. The Germans had lost almost half of the 550,000 men and around 1,500 of the nearly 2,400 armored fighting vehicles destroyed by Allied fire or abandoned by their crews that they had committed to the battle. On 15 August, U.S. and Free French forces opened a new front on the coast of southern France with Operation Dragoon. The German forces under Army Group G were outnumbered from the start, padded out with substandard units, devoid of air cover and uncertain where the Allies would land. This time Hitler did not repeat the mistake of ordering the troops to stand fast, still less counterattack, that had led to Falaise, and he ordered Army Group G to withdraw north. Because the retreat from the south was comparatively timely, it was the best organized aspect of the German effort in that part of France. While some units were earmarked for withdrawal, others were earmarked to cover them. The 11th Panzer Division fought a rearguard action that delayed the Allied advance to the River Rhône. The Americans blamed their failure against the 11th on logistics, but the reality was that their attacks were not sufficiently determined or coordinated to prevail against the Germans' pugnacious resistance. Overall, the Allies missed an even greater opportunity here than in the north. The Germans lost 80 to 100,000 troops in the south, but the Allies failed to destroy the entire 300,000-strong force. However, the retreating Germans were constantly harried by the resistance and by Allied aircraft and artillery. Of course, with the Allies controlling the air, supplies could not move either. The 198th Infantry Division recorded that, of the 30 supply trains that were earmarked for it, only 6 actually arrived where it was fighting. During the retreat, the division had to march exhausting distances on foot, interspersed with desperate counterattacks, before it finally reached a defensive position in the Vosges. We retreated from the Mediterranean, marched day and night, and finally reached the Rhône Valley, recalled Unteroffizier Helmut P. in a letter of 7 September. We were encircled, After many days of hard, bitter fighting, we broke through the encircling ring. The battle was the worst I've ever participated in. The artillery was terrible. We lost many, very many comrades. The southern retreat was generally well coordinated, its rearguard action effective, and much of Army Group G eventually saved. But German units panicked and broke more than they did in the north, and many individual companies surrendered without a fight. A very high proportion of Army Group G's eventual losses were registered as missing, in other words, taken prisoner for the most part. Here, as in the north, German soldiers often surrendered because they expected to be treated well as prisoners, by the Americans at any rate, if not necessarily by the often vengeful Free French. If the German retreat from the south was relatively well organized, the retreat in the north resembled a desperate lunge for the German frontier. The Germans retreating from Normandy were ordered to hold bridgeheads west of the Seine, but there was no hope of that. They were able to retreat to the east of it, however, for the Americans failed to cut off the river at the estuary. Flying weather was poor, and continued resistance in the Falaise pocket diverted Allied air power when it could have been used to destroy bridges over the Seine. Thus were the Germans able to employ ferries, barges, rafts, yachts, and rowing boats, as well as pontoon and boat bridges at night, to get their men across. It was not a smooth, orderly process. The makeshift Seine crossings were hopelessly overcrowded, recalled Hans von Luck. Infantry supply units and parties of stragglers were competing there, sometimes with the use of force for the few ferries. But the Germans' lengthy experience of river crossings in the east helped considerably. Eventually, the Germans salvaged a third of the troops and a tenth of the material they had committed to Normandy. Getting even that much out was an achievement. On 20 August, General Jodl ordered the Germans retreating in the west to take usable trucks, including generators, fuel of every kind, horses, cattle, provisions. Every horse and every truck in the land must be used. What could not be used was to be destroyed. In the event, though plenty of wild plunder took place, the Germans did not subject France to the kind of systematic scorched-earth misery they had inflicted in the east, albeit partly because they did not have the time. The commander asks about plans of minefields, demolitions, inundations, etc., wrote Sergeant W. Cry of the 712th Infantry Division in his diary on 2 September. I haven't the foggiest. I was not briefed sufficiently before leaving. The situation must have got worse, for the officers are standing in front of maps and looking grave. Though the Germans seized 60,000 horses, they did not abduct the male population for labor in the Reich. When it came to demolishing harbor facilities, the Germans usually lacked the time and the explosives to do the job properly, and the Allies had them working again soon after. Prompt Allied action also disrupted the Germans' destruction measures. During the second week in September, for instance, the British captured Le Havre before the Germans could properly wreck the port's harbor facilities. The operation exemplified the growing combined arms proficiency of numerous British units. The British used aerial reconnaissance photos, interrogations of deserters and POWs, and tip-offs from locals to build a comprehensive picture of the German defences. The Royal Navy and RAF coordinated to bombard the town before rapidly attacking the German defenders, under Fortress Commandant Le Havre General Eberhard Wildermuth, before they could ready themselves. Engineers and assault armor of the 51st Highland Division cleared a way through the German minefields for mechanized infantry, personnel carriers, and follow-up armor to pour through. Wildermuth himself was taken prisoner in his pajamas. The retreating Germans generally sought to leave the French population what it needed. For instance, 58 Reserve Panzer Corps took what it deemed necessary from the land, but also paid for it, and the field headquarters in Paris ensured the city's bread supply remained secure. Partly this was for practical reasons. Rapacity might have provoked resistance, something the retreating Germans were in too much of a hurry to spend time suppressing. Partly, however, the Westheer generally retained a clearer sense of correct behavior towards civilians than did the Ostheer in 1944. Even so, impressions of chivalrous German conduct should not detract from the part racial ideology played in shaping how the German army treated different population groups in East and West. Moreover, the Germans did commit excesses during their retreat through France. On 29 August, a battalion of the 3rd Panzergrenadier Division, recently arrived from Italy, killed 86 civilians, albeit no women and children. The security police and SD killed many of the captives in their prisons before they pulled out. And the French resistance, having been renamed the Force Française de l'Intérieur on 23 June, itself sometimes killed German prisoners, mainly from the SS and police or from Eastern units. Events also took a vicious turn in Paris just before it was liberated. Field Marshal von Kluge had wanted the French capital spared street fighting and scorched earth,